Hi, welcome to The Long View. My name is Dave Danielson, and again, The Long View is a program where we try to look at subjects that are going to be impacting you, your family, and the community maybe 25 to 30 years out. Our guest today is Chief Deb Pendergast, who is the director of the New Hampshire Fire Academy. And welcome.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you. Well, the first thing I think we should do is learn, how did you get to be Chief, how did you get to be the director of the New Hampshire Fire Academy?
Okay, I'll start off with I began my career in the fire and emergency services back in 1992 after having my third daughter. I was a business owner at the time and not really satisfied with where my career was going, and started out taking an emergency medical technician class and found out that I really loved that. Did that for a little while. Started as a volunteer with the Hampstead Rescue Squad. Did about a year there volunteering as an EMT. Decided to take it to the next level and took a certification course to become an intermediate EMT. And along with that came some ride-along time in the local fire department. At the day, it was back in Derry. So I rode on Derry's fire department ambulance to get some EMT time. And one of my first calls on the ambulance was actually a structure fire. And working with the paramedics and doing some of my EMT training, I decided to branch out and get some fire training under my belt also. So once I got hired on, at the time, East Derry Fire Department, I was an on-call part-time firefighter and had found my niche. I knew that's what I loved to do. I woke up in the morning and had a passion to do it. And worked there for several years, got hired full-time as a career firefighter, went on to get promoted to lieutenant, and again wanted to continue on up the ladder. There was an opportunity available at that time in the city of Laconia for a deputy fire chief of training and operations. Put my hat in the ring for that, and eventually got hired there in the second in command position for Laconia.
Deb, you used a number of phrases here. I think that folks might want to know the difference of when we refer to firefighters, because a lot of folks, for example, in this particular area, in the Bedford area, would recognize a professional firefighter as working 40 hours, at least 40 hours a week,
Sure.
or up to 40 hours a week. And you mentioned phrase call
Okay.
and part-time. And there are differences between those, and I was wondering if you might be able to explain the differences.
Sure. Well, here in New Hampshire, about 69 to 70% of firefighters are what we call on-call or part-time, or in some cases in the state, actual volunteer, where there is no pay or remuneration for what you do. On-call and combination departments are very popular, where a department may have a couple of folks, maybe a chief and a firefighter and a lieutenant on duty 24/7, and then that is backed up with an on-call force. So men and women that will have a pager and be toned out when there's a need for them to respond to the station or to an incident. So
Okay.
those are what we call on-call
I see.
firefighters.
When I moved into town here, there are a number of volunteers. And today there are a few volunteers. I think we might have two call firefighters today in Bedford. But volunteer firefighters are getting harder and harder to first recruit, I think, and then to maintain, probably because of jobs, would you think?
Volunteerism across the country, it's not just a New Hampshire problem. Volunteerism is on a downswing. I think folks today often have two jobs, or have a job and have other activities, whether it's sports or civic activities and civic groups. I think the commitment of an individual to their community is not the same as it was 40 or 50 years ago. Folks today don't feel that same commitment to have to turn around and do some service in their community. So I think for that reason, volunteerism is down, and the fire service is feeling that as well.
Yet the emergency doesn't stop to say, "Oh, I know you all have different jobs." And in doing some research, I noticed that back, probably, definitely in World War II, and probably before then, probably since then, a number of women were called out to supplement the organizations, the fire organizations that men had previously been in, because the men weren't here. Is there still that opportunity, particularly in the instance where you said volunteers are harder to get today? Is there that opportunity now for younger women, particularly, to get involved? Not necessarily younger women, but middle-aged women too, who may feel that they want to contribute. Is there still that opportunity?
So is the opportunity there? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The opportunity is available. I will tell you that the fire service in America is not very diverse. Currently, only about 3% of the career firefighters in America are female. Mm-hmm. So it's not heavily involved. Women aren't heavily involved in the fire service in this country. Some countries a little more so, but other countries are having the same lack of diversity issues that we have here in America. Right. So I think you mentioned the other problem, volunteerism being down, diversity being not quite where it could be. Let's marry those two things together. And I think if departments really open up who they're recruiting to, start talking to women's organizations, women's sports teams, that sort of thing, I think we can solve two problems. We can help diversify the fire service and maybe get more folks involved in the volunteerism.
Do you feel that women might be intimidated about joining? Certainly social intimidation, but how about physical intimidation? Is there any of that you see with younger women looking at what firefighters are challenged to do? And certainly some of your colleagues, mm-hmm. I've met some of your colleagues, and they're certainly capable of pulling a hose and raising a ladder and doing those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But do you think folks might have that in the back of their mind?
There probably is some intimidation because, let's face it, over the course of the years when we think in our mind of what a firefighter looks like, it's generally a 6'2" male, rather stocky or athletic build. Right. So a woman just doesn't picture herself in that position. I think the more and more female role models we have, that will certainly help with that. I think one thing to consider, and when I've done some recruiting, what we talk about is the fire service isn't just fires now. The Excellent. Fire service is Excellent. So diverse. Emergency medical services, of course, is a very large part of what right. most fire departments do. There's opportunities for code enforcement, fire prevention, public education, public health, emergency management. So fire service is a very broad category that women certainly can fit into if they're not thrilled with the idea of the physical aspect of the fire service, then certainly some of the other opportunities, again, whether it's public education, code enforcement, fire prevention, right. there are many successful women in those parts of the fire service also.
And you mentioned the emergency medical services part, mm-hmm. which is growing. The demand for emergency
Absolutely.
Medical services mm-hmm. is growing. Mm-hmm. And the requirements for that are becoming... I don't want to sound like it's more difficult to get in, but it takes some time and it takes some experience mm-hmm. to grow in that business.
Correct. So a person would need to be registered in New Hampshire. You get take a long course, 120, 130 hours to become an EMT.
Which can be done at night, right?
It can be. It can yep. be done nights and Thank weekends yep. during the week. There are several different opportunities for that type of education. Mm-hmm. You would take a national test, become national registry registered. Then you would apply to the state of New Hampshire for an EMT license. And along with that licensing process, of course, you learn the state protocols and what we can and can't do, what drugs can we use, what treatment do we use for sick patients.
Are protocols like directions?
Protocols are like directions. The protocols are actually written by one of the medical boards okay. that meets at the Fire and EMS Academy. Right. Protocols would be, for example, someone having a stroke. There's a checklist of what you would do for that stroke patient.
Right. And I think, you know, prior to introduce you as director of the Fire Academy, what I didn't say was that you're also responsible for the Bureau of Emergency Medical Services in New Hampshire.
That's
I didn't
correct.
Mention that. Mm-hmm. So those folks all report onto you as well.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. Currently in the state of New Hampshire, it's difficult to get exact numbers because, again, volunteerism, folks may retire or decide not to volunteer anymore. We've got new folks coming in. But currently there are about 8,100 active firefighters, career, volunteer, on-call, part-time, mm-hmm. and about 5,300 licensed EMTs, paramedics, and medical providers.
Can one become an EMT in the same kind of way that a firefighter can be? Can they be a call? Can they be a call EMT? Can they be a volunteer EMT?
Absolutely. EMT, again, could be your career that you do it full time, or it could be volunteer or on call. There are many diverse services for emergency medical incidents also.
Mm-hmm. And as I've read that the emergency medical services business is changing dramatically. One of your officers who was here, Nick McCurry, mm-hmm. was here a little while ago to talk about the changing nature of emergency medical services becoming almost like the emergency room today.
That is correct. With some of the healthcare changes, as you know, with the Affordable Care Act, there have been some changes with billing and insurance. Really, emergency medical service, which was historically up to this point what we consider pre-hospital care, now is starting to venture out to become out-of-hospital care. So emergency medical services are becoming a little bit more proactive, that we may respond to Mrs. Jones in the community to keep her out of the hospital rather than waiting for her to call 911 that she needs to get to the hospital.
Excellent. I'm going to take a dramatic turn here, staying in line with the idea of the emergency medical services and the emergencies in particular. Mm-hmm. 2 years ago, I think, we had up Maine, they had a train that went out of control and mm-hmm. Crashed into a town, and tremendous conflagration of fire and disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Today, a lot of folks don't realize, or probably they do realize, that coming up and down our highways or running up and down our highways are trucks that are loaded with some pretty interesting things. Are we prepared to deal with that? Probably with the train, you probably wouldn't see it as large as the main incident, mm-hmm. but are we prepared?
Dave, I feel like you can never be too prepared. No such thing as over-preparation. Certainly, we have teams, and there's pockets in the state that have particular hazards that aren't found in other parts of the state. So it's up to the chief in that jurisdiction to be sure that their force that's going to be responding to these types of incidents do have that training. But we've got, again, teams in the state that can back up fire and EMS agencies. For example, we've got regional hazardous materials response teams. So if there were a large fuel spill or a tractor-trailer incident that had hazardous materials, certainly that fire agency would be the first to respond on scene. They would take some actions based on their training, but they would call it for backup from these hazardous materials teams to support their incident response.
Excellent. I think probably people aren't aware of what's going up and down the turnpike, mm-hmm. but it's good to know that there's somebody that's standing by to just in case.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Another question I had was changing demographics mm-hmm. again, and this time within southern New Hampshire in particular, in central New Hampshire, there's changing demographics with the languages that are spoken and the cultures mm-hmm. that are here. Has the fire service made an attempt to try to keep up with those culturals and linguistic changes mm-hmm. that their customers, their residents are experiencing?
I can speak to the New Hampshire example. Not quite sure what's going on in the rest of the country as far as that's concerned. But as you may know, there are 11 refugee resettlement communities here in New Hampshire. My experience 10 years with the city of Laconia, that was one of those refugee resettlement communities. Mm-hmm. I think it's important that the fire chief, again, know his or her community. If you've got that refugee population in your community, it's incumbent on us to respond to that. An initiative that we took up in the city of Laconia is I myself was the liaison to the refugee community, and we did fire safety education for these folks coming
in.
Most of the new folks that were coming into our community took English as a second language courses. As part of that course, I spoke with the instructor, and they did field trips to our fire station. They got to meet our EMTs and our firefighters. They got to see our trucks, and we explained what 911 is, when you should call, what it's for, that sort of thing. So I think it's important you talk about the communities that, again, a fire service leader make sure they're looking at those mini communities within their community, whether it's you have a home for the blind or whatever your mini communities are, that you are responsive to those folks.
Right. You mentioned earlier, and again with reference to Chief, you mentioned in your career mm-hmm. moving up the ladder in your career. But you talked about this was the education that I got, and you just spoke again about how a chief has to be mm-hmm. knowledgeable about going on. Can you explain the education process now that's available to the chief? There is a National Fire Academy,
mm-hmm.
But can you explain the different opportunities that a chief has or a firefighter mm-hmm. has in order to move up through the ranks?
Sure. Well, I think as a state, we do a pretty good job. Our academy and other associations, for example, Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire and New Hampshire Association of Fire Chiefs, we're all very pro higher education. So the firefighters, as they go through their training, there are places in the state, for example, Lakes Region Community College, that has a fire science degree program. So not only do you get your fire certifications, but that's backed up with an associate's degree in the education that goes along with that. And there are opportunities with many of the state colleges and universities that are would help out a fire chief or a chief officer. Administration degrees and leadership and management degrees, public administration, that sort of thing. And certainly those are all very encouraged.
So this is truly an executive professional organization today, as opposed to just showing up and putting out a fire.
We like to think so.
Yeah. Another area that I know you're very much interested in the old days, when I was a kid, there was an expression for firefighters called smoke eaters, because indeed that's what it seemed a lot of them used to do. I can think of a couple of folks that were neighbors of ours that were like that. Today we learned that firefighting can be deadly. It's a deadly profession. And what has happened to cause firefighting to become, not necessarily smoke eating can't be healthy anyway, but what has caused it to become more deadly?
Well, we have to today, we do have to think about structure fires, whether it's a residential fire, a commercial, industrial fire. A fire nowadays is a lot more like a hazardous materials event. And what I mean by that is the number of carcinogens and toxins. Not only have they increased, the variety of carcinogens increased, but certainly the intensity and the concentrations of those have increased. So you're probably asking, why is that? Think about a legacy home. Think about your grandmother and grandfather's home, my grandmother and grandfather's home. Back in the day, and even before that, you know, pine floors as opposed to carpeting. Furnishings were made of very natural materials, burlaps and wool and cotton and those types of materials. And think of our homes today. We've got wall-to-wall carpeting, which are materials that have petroleum products in them. They're made of nylons and synthetic fibers. Today's furnishings, again, synthetic fibers. Back in my grandmother's day, she was lucky if she had maybe one television or one radio in the home. Today, we've got televisions, computers, electronics in every room of our home. And of course, when those things burn, the synthetic fibers, the electronics, they give off a multitude of carcinogens and toxins. So of course, we've got protective equipment that we wear, and we say, you know, we're encapsulated, we're safe if we wear them. Well, we're finding out that's not necessarily true. We maybe take our mask off a little bit sooner than we should. The fire's out, there's a little bit of smoke, we're overhauling a structure fire. That is probably one of the more dangerous times. There's a lot of particulate floating in the air that we're breathing into our lungs. The gases that are off-gassing from the burned materials, that is getting absorbed into our gear, it's getting into our skin, it's being inhaled, and we're finding out that that's really causing a lot of fire service cancers.
Mm-hmm. It's obviously a problem, but another problem that I don't think people are aware of, we're changing nature of the vehicles today, fuel in vehicles. I mean, we're talking about it from a revenue point of gasoline, but vehicles today aren't gasoline fired necessarily. Today they are, we have natural gas, we have hybrids, we just have a number of different fuels. Are firefighters staying in current with, and how do you respond to something like that?
That's actually a very big challenge, Dave. Thank you for bringing that up. So, again, electric vehicles. If you think of a motor vehicle collision, you've maybe seen on the side of a highway where the jaws of life were being used or a cutting tool. Back with fueled vehicles, we know where it's safe to cut, where it's not safe to cut. Right. In an electric vehicle, they're not all the same. They're different. You may be cutting a post or a part of a floorboard to help remove a trapped victim, and you may be cutting into a high voltage line. So it's really, really important. There are trainings available. It's really important that firefighters stay up to date and get all those trainings they can so that they're safe when they're responding.
So this is becoming more and more intriguing here, because not only is it a management a more professional managed organization, but it's also becoming a highly scientific, technical type of organization that's going to be challenging young firefighters to be coming into the profession.
That's right. And as a training agency, we're constantly trying to keep up with new technology and new innovations and making sure the training is available.
We talked about the incendiary, the chemicals and things like that in the Morden House. What can we do? What can folks who are watching this show, how do they look into the future? How will they be able to protect their families in their homes? Is there a way, because we're not going to change the things that we're buying,
That's
I
right.
don't think. Mm-hmm. How can we protect our families?
Well, certainly you want to be sure that a couple of things are in place. Today in this country, about 95% of homes are protected by smoke detectors. I will say 95% of homes have smoke detectors. A certain percentage of those may not be working, may not have up-to-date batteries, but most homes have smoke detectors. Again, you want to be sure that you've got working smoke detectors. One smoke detector in the home is truly not enough. When you think about your family sleeping, if there's a smoke detector on the first floor, and you're sleeping up on a second floor, actually it's about 20 decibels less if you're away from the smoke detector. That may not be enough to wake you. So certainly we recommend smoke detectors on every level of the home and also in the bedrooms. If you close your bedroom door, again, you want to be able to hear that. One thing that we're really in support of here in New Hampshire that we're looking to get maybe possibly some more legislation is residential fire sprinklers. I can tell you what you see on TV when you see sprinklers setting off is really not the case. A small fire can be detected by one sprinkler head. It will fuse. One head can put out a beginning fire, and that's in incipient phases. A sprinkler system, the cost from what I'm hearing numbers about $1.50 to $1.60 per square foot of a home. So if you've got a 2,000 square foot home that you're building, really only about $3,000 to put in a good protection system for your home. Most people wouldn't blink an eye at upgrading to granite countertops for $3,000. Mm-hmm. You know, why wouldn't you consider that same cost for a sprinkler
system? Is there an insurance
system?
Benefit in that kind of case?
There is. Most insurance companies will give anywhere from 5 to 25% discount on the fire portion of your insurance policy if you've got a sprinkler system. And I'll tell you one little fact. Doing my research, a sprinkler can put out a small fire with generally less than 300 gallons of water. If the local fire department comes to your home, that same fire, which will have grown a little bit because a couple of minutes for them to respond, over 3,000 gallons. So not only will you have more smoke and fire damage, you'll have more water damage. So certainly the one sprinkler can put out a fire with a lot less damage.
I remember someone told me once, and so it'd be interesting to hear your opinion, that a domestic sprinkler system, the reason for a sprinkler is to save property, not lives. Sprinklers will not save lives. They'll save property, but not necessarily lives. True?
No. Okay. I would say that's not true. Sprinklers can save lives. So we'll use the incidence of a fire maybe started by electrical causes, starts at 2 o'clock in the morning while the family is sleeping. If that fire starts in the basement sprinklered, that sprinkler can activate and have the fire out before the smoke even gets to and alerts the smoke detectors of that family that's sleeping in the home. Mm-hmm. There has never been, to my knowledge, in this country, a multi-fatality fire in a building that has been sprinklered.
Wow.
So sprinklers do save lives.
I guess that's an endorsement. Mm-hmm. Endorsement. We've got a couple of minutes left. And again, from your perspective, which is pretty extraordinary, coming from the EMS background, the fire background, the administrative background, what would you like to say to folks who are looking at the fire service as the first responder service and its changes that it's going to see over the next few years?
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that folks should be aware of is certainly to support their fire department, whether it comes budget time, town meeting time. What firefighters and EMTs are faced with nowadays, like we've talked about, is so much more than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago. And it's really, really important that we not only get the budget to be trained again to some of the things we were talking about, to have the apparatus and equipment that allows them to respond safely. But that's going to be the best protection for the communities, is to really support the fire and EMS services in their communities.
And actually, this is a throwback question, so I apologize for this one. This is a throwback question to when I was a kid. I can remember, and I was in the city here in Manchester, but I can remember fire trucks being in my neighborhood every so often and firefighters coming to my house and doing an inspect. I assumed that that's what that was called, an inspection. Mm-hmm. I did not know. Mm-hmm. But I remember them going down to my cellar and looking at the furnace and looking at things like that. Do folks still do that?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's a good thing for our viewers, is the fire service is not just a response agency, that we try to be very, very proactive. We want to be sure if there's a new commercial business coming into town that the building is safe for folks to visit. We do fire inspections for that. We still do get out into schools, and we're happy to teach children about fire safety. Many communities also go into senior citizen complexes and make sure the folks are very aware of safe cooking practices and things like that. So it shouldn't be uncommon for you to see a fire truck that's out in the community without its lights and sirens on, just doing very proactive education.
Right. And again, if I could go just back, because we got a little bit of time left, is that for folks who want to get some of this information and they want to learn more about how prepared are their fire departments, do they need more revenue to try to help them address some of the problems? Should they call their chief? Should they talk to the firefighters? How should they try to interact to get more information?
I think most fire chiefs would welcome that. That's actually, we the positions that I've been in, we're very happy to educate the community. They're actually, people aren't always aware of some of the types of responses we go to, some of the types of equipment that we have that need to be maintained. You know, what does a fire truck do besides putting out a fire? Some of the other things, some of the rescue tools that we carry, and honestly, how expensive some of these things are that we need to do our job. So I know most fire chiefs in the state would welcome members from the community to come in and ask questions, attend meetings.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you, first of all, Deb, for being here today.
It's been my pleasure.
I know it takes time away from what you do. And I also want to thank you very much for the professionalism that you've tried to instill in the departments, the chiefs, and the folks that we have training up at the academy, because it's a tough job, as you've indicated. And it's not only the tough job physically now, but it's a tough job scientifically, knowledge-wise, emotionally, all of those qualities. So thank you very much for all that you're doing, and thank you very much for being here.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity, Dave.
Thanks very much. And thank you very much for joining us tonight, or today, I'm sorry, joining us today on The Long View. We hope we've given you some, and Deb's given you some information that you can think about how the fire service is changing, how it's affecting your family's life, how it's affecting your life, and how you can make some changes, or think about making some changes, that are going to help you in the future. Thanks again for joining us on The Long View, and I look forward to speaking to you again.